This episode of the FitCast is brought to you by the PTAdvantage.com, an online personal training solution to help trainers save time and make more money. It is hands down the best resource that I found out there. You can check them out at thePTAdvantage.com. Hello and welcome to this episode of the FitCast. This is episode number 281. I am Kevin Larrabee, and along with me back again for the second week in a row. That's about as regular as the podcast has been in a long time. Lee Peel. Lee, what's up?
That is I. I am back.
Regularity.
Still without a name, or at least like a tag name. You know, I got to figure out something. I was talking about it, the captain thing.
Yeah, you know, but you know, whatever. So we have a great show lined up for you today. The thing is, we got a ton of, like, we had questions left over from last time, and then we got a ton more.
And I didn't even tell you about the questions that I was going to answer. We didn't do that with the off topic. That I'm not going to answer. I'm just telling you that right now.
Two quick things I want to mention. First off, you know, you heard it a second ago, but the guys at the PT Advantage have stuck around for another phase of advertising to really help pay the bandwidth bills. So thank you to them, and you know, thank you to everyone out there. If you do want to help support the show, you can also go to thefitcast.com. There's a little donation tab on the right-hand side. If you like what you're hearing and you like to support the show, that is the best way to do it. And the other thing I wanted to, in the off-topic discussion, we usually joke about this stuff, but really you should probably not listen to it in the car with your kids.
Yeah, you really actually should.
Or with your parents around, or potentially with your significant
your wife.
Other. Yeah. So keep that in mind as you go into the off-topic discussion, or feel free to fast forward now, listen to it, and then come back here. But like I said, we have a huge show because you guys out there were so great about submitting questions for Lee. And I think we should really just waste no more time. We should get right into it because we'll try to squeeze in as many as time will allow us.
Let's do it.
Awesome. And yeah, there's some super, super interesting questions. So I'm going to kind of jump around on that thing that I sent you, Lee. So I might not necessarily go descending.
Okay.
On some stuff that I want to hit on, mostly for the most part, though. So it's an interesting question. Hot topic from Tracy. Hi, Kevin and Lee. I was wondering what research shows in regard with wheat. Does it cause inflammation in the body? Does it have a place in a pre-contest bodybuilding diet, primarily for females? Also, do fiber carbs count? For example, bran cereal contains the same fiber content as carbs. Does this mean the carb count is zero, even with the added sugar? Thanks so much. Love your work. Love the FitCast. Together with Tom Venuto, you all do an amazing job showing us how to live the fitness and bodybuilding lifestyle while improving health of both body and mind. Look at that. You and Tom Venuto.
I know.
Right there.
And did could you feel, even though I didn't say anything, could you feel the sigh that happened and the rapid heartbeat?
I heard the swoon.
There's always a swoon. There's two questions in this really that are kind of separate. I want to cover the inflammation one. I guess we'll do that part last. We'll do the kind of carbs fiber thing first. Basically, how that the amount of calories that you uptake from a fiber material is very small. It's basically classified as non-significant. So if you're eating carbohydrates and it has stats listed as just being fibrous carbohydrates for like the whole amount, like if you're just eating fiber, that would not taste very good. So chances are it's just not listing the technical sugar content of the food, which I always get kind of aggravated with that, since that to some degree, all carbohydrates do have kind of like a sugar type property to them on a basic level. But in short, you can note that if the fiber content or if the listed content, nutritional content of the food is like, let's say it's listed as like 20 grams of carbohydrates, and then it says there are 8 grams that are fibrous carbohydrates, you can pretty much say that only 12, did I had that upright? Yes. Only about 12 of the carbohydrate intake that you're taking in is going to be very calorically impacting or based upon the times four, because as we know, like carbohydrates are roughly 4 calories per gram, somewhere in that zone. There is some estimates. I cannot remember right off the top of my head. I believe it was something around 1 gram, I mean, 1 calorie for every gram of fibrous carbs, something like that. So if you had like 7 grams of fibrous carbohydrates, that you're looking at maybe 1 caloric impact per gram. I think it was something like that. Do not keep me to that though. I might need to reference that. But in general, you can kind of look at it like that. I'm not huge on packaged foods, and I don't mean that in any sort of judgmental way. I'm very with like the whole food items. And I kind of think if you're eating packaged food, that might be one of the last things that you need to be worrying about a little bit, in a manner of speaking, because it should be kind of smaller into your portion of eating in the day. But yeah, if you see that, that's just kind of how to take it into account. I wouldn't really think too much about that other than that. There are still calorically impacted carbs. So even if it doesn't say like sugar carbs, you know, sometimes it'll list underneath the amount of carbs and sugar is X amount of carbohydrates, and it'll be like 5 or something like that. And then you're like, okay, well, if this is fibrous and this is sugar, is that it? Is there nothing left? Well, there is stuff left. There is still calories that impact, even if they're not technically labeled as sugar calories. So anyway, that's the answer to that question. With the other question that is talking about wheat and inflammation, I love this question because I think that it's a common thing we see all over the place. Gluten or wheat is very inflammatory. If you want to decrease your inflammatory diseases or inflammatory problems, then stop eating wheat, stop eating gluten, and these things will be solved. However, it's not quite that simple, and it never is that simple. So what's inflammation? And I'll try to keep this short and not go in too much of detail, but inflammation is a system of repair and healing in the body. When the body senses a reaction taking place, some sort of attack or some sort of damage, the body is going to respond through various things. It'll swell, it'll get red, it'll increase in heat. All types of these things are what's taking place. So, it is the number one killer of man, inflammation. But what is also not talked about is that it is the number one killer of man. And you have to have it. If you have even the slightest cut on your finger, it's going to turn red, you bleed, and the surrounding tissue in that area is going to respond with some sort of puffiness or swelling or these types of things. And what's happening is it's killing off bad cells, and it's helping for good cells to repair and recover. And it is a give and take response. It is not just all bad. It's not all good. It's just what has to happen. Sometimes, or the problems, when the problems come in is, let's say that cut was a very bad cut, and there was an infection or too much of an inflammatory response, then the areas in which that the body is trying to kill off those cells grows and grows and grows and grows, and you could end up losing your arm or the area, a complete appendage, because you got a cut and an infection and it grows. So that's a process, but in a manner of speaking, though, it is still protecting you because it's keeping it. It's trying to keep it from traveling upwards and upwards and upwards into other organs and other parts of your body. So it is trying to kill as fast as it can. Another thing, what we commonly talk about is like peanut allergies. An anaphylactic response takes place to literally try and shut down your body from being able to ingest more of something that it thinks is attacking you. But in doing so, you can end up dying from that. So that's, you know, what a very brief and extremely, extremely layman and really poor overview of what inflammation is. But that's just a little look at it. So to say, though, that inflammation is caused or not caused by a certain amount of food is just kind of silly. We have, and this is what I use for an example very often, we have so many inflammatory disorders and so many problems like you can't even possibly understand. In the medical field, when they hear layman people talk about, and even myself talk about these things, it's laughable to them because of the things that they have to face on a daily basis with inflammatory responses. And it is the problem in the emergency room, I assure you. And so if you look at something very simple, though, let's look at something that a lot of us can relate to or understand, like acne. If you look at something like acne, most people will say, oh, well, if you stop eating carbohydrates or you should stop eating this food or that food, your acne is going to go away. It is going to disappear and it'll be fine and you'll never have that again. We know from research, we know from anecdotes that is not true, that there are multiple reasons that someone can have an acne response. It can be due to infection, clothing, temperatures, diets, allergies, you name it, it is there. And we have doctors and researchers left and right trying to figure out how to solve this one problem of bumps rising on skin, and they've been trying to figure it out for years, and they've used all kinds of really aggressive drugs and aggressive treatments, and they literally throw everything they can throw at this, and they still can't figure it out on any sort of real large level. So if you can look at a complex problem such as that, and then think that ingesting wheat is going to shut down your entire system and be more aggressive or have more of a response problem than, say, really harsh drugs, I think that's not being very logical. I think that you have to understand that it is a response thing to a very particular problem, and it is very individual to every single person. And just ingesting wheat, for the average person who has no medical problem or medical issues with it, does not mean that there is going to be a pro-inflammatory response that is above or abnormal, by the way, than any other food or inflammatory response that you're going to have, because all foods and all eating to some degree has an inflammatory response or a reactionary response in the body, because, well, it has to, because that's how we ingest and digest things. But what I think is interesting, and something that I read recently, was a study came out, I think it was 2012 study came out, and it was talking about the consumption of wheat gluten, like a wheat gluten protein, like whey protein, things like that, post-training in running athletes, and they also did it in soccer players. And in both of those instances, they saw that versus placebo, that there was a decrease. Let me make this very clear. There's a decrease in inflammation response, meaning that the creatine kinase that happens whenever we injure muscles or we have any sort of damage to our muscle tissue, it increases. That's what happens when we damage muscle tissue. And with the ingestion of the wheat gluten, straight up wheat protein here is what we're talking about, we actually saw a decrease in that inflammation process. So there's not a lot of studies that look at this specifically, but there was a running study, and then they followed up with a soccer study. And in both of those instances, they saw an anti-inflammatory response from the intake of wheat gluten. So when you look at things like that, it can cause you to question the kind of statements that are made about taking in wheat. If you have any sort of inflammatory issues based upon wheat, could there be allergies? Can people have problems with taking up wheat? Yes, absolutely. It's not uncommon, and it is something that can take place for people, but it's still a very small percentage of the population that's going to have a problem. And it also, you do not know if it's just the wheat, because with wheat, it's very rare that you're just eating wheat. You could be eating bread that has been produced in a facility, that there could be other chemicals or other agents that bother you. There could be a myriad of reasons why these things are taking place or you're having a problem. So what I would question or what I would do if I was the individual worrying about such things is I would just see what I have a response to in whatever I can acknowledge. And then if I have a negative response, then maybe try removing the variables. So for example, if you have a problem with store-bought bread, maybe try making homemade bread. And it could be a preservative or something that is in that bread that is causing you a problem and not the actual wheat itself. That's the same thing with many other types of things. You can always just try and take out the variables, take out the issues, and you may find that there's something that's not actually the wheat product, but that is commonly associated with store brand wheat products that could be a problem for you, and so on and so forth. So I guess my short answer is when looking at body composition or when you're trying to get stage ready or things like that, it's not usually a one food item that is an issue, be it dairy or these kinds of things. It's the collective of your caloric intake. It's how much of that you're taking in, your training process, how lean you are in body fat, If you have to do water manipulations or carbohydrate manipulations, that should happen at the very end. And in general, I believe in eating the way that you eat throughout the whole season up until right your contest time. And hopefully you can get away with still during contest time with mild manipulations. And I really wouldn't worry or be concerned about one food that is going to be a problem or not be a problem, because in 10 years, I assure you, you're probably going to be asking the same kind of question, or someone's going to be asking the same kind of question about eggs or about some other new food that's come along. I just saw kale got taken down recently, which I was amazed and shocked by, that kale actually is biting the bullet now. So, you know, it's just one of those things, but hopefully that answers the question on a little bit of a interesting or different detail than what you might be normally hearing.
Cool. Yeah. It's a huge bummer that Screech's little experiment in the lab that cleared up acne for the whole school. You know, it just caused everyone's face to turn red.
Maroon.
That's what it was. Yeah. Bummer. Next time. Another interesting question. Again, we got some really cool questions from the audience, and I hope I pronounced this name correctly. I'm going to say Haj. Hey, Kevin, this may be a stupid question, but I wanted to ask Lee how supplement companies can assure customers that whenever we take a scoop of a pre-post-workout powder, that we get the dosage that are listed that we are getting the dosages that are listed on the label. For example, can they claim that I get 300 milligrams of caffeine in one scoop when there's a possibility that I could get 250 in one or 350 in another, especially when there's a bunch of ingredients? And what about those in microgram dosages? There has to be some variations, right? Thanks, bro, and keep up the great work.
Yeah, I mean, it's not a stupid question. It is kind of a simple question. There are certain regulations or standards that each company has to abide by, or when you're submitting things for stats and FDA, and also most of these things aren't even submitted for approval. So there's always a lot of room for discrepancy or errors, and that's why whenever you are looking at products and you want to know how much what their labels are comparing to what it is they say, do the best you can to investigate products through places like consumerlabs.com, things like that. They do tests on different supplement companies, like, for example, like Twin Labs. They have a product that they say contains X amount of milligrams of this or a certain amount of substance of that. They actually test those substances independently, and they see, does it have what they actually say in it? Is this what's actually taking place? Are their formulas correct? And you can kind of judge your supplement use or how you buy your supplements based upon that, or how well you feel the company is just a reputable company. But generally speaking, it's kind of like cooking. They make a batch of their stuff. You know, they put their ingredients in, they kind of mix it all in, and they have a certain lot of amount that they assume is going to be in each scoop of whatever it is that they do. How you scoop that item is also going to make a difference. Most of the scoops that you get don't have lines on them. They're just they just have like a top and bottom, so to speak. But the point is, like, usually it's a finger push off the top for a clean top is what is considered a serving, or the gram amount that they have given in weight is going to be that. So if it says 28 grams per scoop of an item equals X amount of calories, X amount of protein, X amount of what have you, caffeine. If you weigh it, you can know for a better estimate that you're going to get it correct and at least as close to the stats that they have given us. Now, we have to take on blind faith that those stats are correct. And for the most part, unless they have been evaluated from an independent company. You can actually take, and this is something that the average person can do if they ever want to plunk their money into it. If you have a lot of money and you want to, there's a lot of independent labs that are in various cities. Obviously, it's going to be more of a bigger city area, but we even have one here in Greensboro. And you can take your food item or your supplement item or whatnot and get it analyzed in a lab and figured out what the content of the stuff is. It's costly, but you can do it. But in short, go by the gram amount that it gives you, assess that and take your dosages off of that. And that's how you're going to know roughly what you're going to get. Now, is that going to be absolutely correct? I can't tell you. It's going to be based upon each company, but let's just hope that they're being ethical and that their formula, and their mixture, if you will, matches up to the gram amount that they give. But with scooping, just so you know, it's usually a clear cut off the top, or if they have a line in the scoop, which some do, it's right at the line of the scoop, not at the top of the scoop, and that kind of lets you know where it's at.
Well, I mean, it brings up a good, you brought up a good point of just like finding companies that are really great and that are reputable. Yeah. Because even like, this is really interesting because literally today, a couple hours before we are recorded the show, there's actually a senator that's lobbying for an inquiry on Herbalife, a super popular supplement company out there that lots of people push their stuff. And you know, you never know when you could be getting a you know, a supplement from a company that could just be fudging what they're putting on it. It happens all the time, and these stories end up coming out. So just, it's worth researching the companies. And that's why I talked to the guys at examine.com and about, it'd be really cool if they were able to find, you know, some way of talking about just a list of reputable companies, but they just talk about no companies and all their material. But I don't know, are there any off the top of your head that do general, you know, supplements that people should kind of steer towards in your opinion or in your experience? Well,
yeah, I mean, I'll keep it short in the sense of like, yeah, there's that big debate on whether supplements should be used or not, right? Mm-hmm. And then how much they're useful. Protein powder supplements and things of that nature, I mean, protein powder is just convenience. That's yeah, really all that boils down to. I think that True Protein is a good company. There is some debate, if you will, about the taste factor, or people get confused about how to mix it. So sometimes True Protein can provide problems for the consumer and getting exactly what it is they want. But I think that they're a good company. I know that there's been a lot of investigation and testing of the On company, like On Whey Protein and things like that. And that they usually come out pretty good with what it is that they say that they've done. There aren't a lot that I would be too sketched from. There's a lot of that have been, basically the newer the companies, the less that they've likely to been tested, the less likely that their things have been run through a rigor by somebody. So you just kind of have to hope that it's a good company or that there's good people behind it with that. As far as supplements go or vitamins or things like that, Twin Labs is always delivering on their promises of what's in their product. They've been tested by consumer labs a lot. And they also have a lot of multivitamin and allergy-free products and things like that. So I like their products. For they're cheap too. Like their iron is like, it's like $6 for like a huge 180 bottle of like 180 capsules. Like, you know, there's just, they're pretty cheap and their products test well. So I like them. Kirkland? Usually test very well, and don't have a lot of problems with them. My mind's going a little blank, but seriously, even if you just do it for a month, plunk some money into, if you're someone that uses his stuff, plunk some money into consumerlabs.com. You can literally look up different supplement companies and you can see if they've passed or failed for certain things that they've claimed, if they have like too high of like mercury or something, that all these kinds of things, like plunk some money into it or, you know, just be a part of it for a little while, look at some stuff and then you can cancel. It's like $9 or something. It's ridiculously cheap. So do something like that. And that's another way that you can investigate some stuff.
Very cool. All right, let's go on to the next question from Sarah B. from Baltimore. I watched a TED Talk by Sandra. I should never do a podcast because I never pronounce last names.
Just have fun with it because that's a really, I don't know.
Why dieting doesn't usually work, where she talks about, quote, set points that they can be raised but not lowered, intuitive eating, mindful eating, etc. Would be interested in Lee's views on this. I have a vague memory of it being discussed before. Good call it was, but I think it's good to bring up to some extent. But if Lee has seen some talk, I would be happy to hear her comments on it. Oh, sorry, this is from Jonas. I don't know if I said, I don't think I did, but I said it was from Sarah.
Yeah, you said, it's because fault. It was listed right underneath.
It's because it's, I did a bad job formatting the outline. It's my fault.
It's fine.
I've only done 280 episodes.
You think you'd learn by now.
Whatever.
I have seen the talk. I don't remember it verbatim by any sense of the term. I should have probably watched it before I came on here. But I guess we can just still kind of talk about the general things that she's talking about anyway. It's not like I have to get in a point by point debate with her. Overall, I did enjoy the talk, and I thought that there are some great things that were said. Talking about set points, I think that's probably where most people are going to be interested. Yes, I have talked about set points before, but hey, why not? Let's just talk about it again. There's a lot of debate about set points. It is a, I wouldn't say that it is a made up term per se, but it's not as if that this is it's a broad spectrum term. It's kind of like saying like IBS. It's like, it just, you have irritable bowels. Why? We don't know why. So it's a very broad term, set points. And basically what it is associating to, or control, if you've not heard the term before, it's talking about the fact that we have a metabolic place or a weight stable place that we can get to in which that is comfortable for us as each individual. And so, for example, a woman of 5'4" feels or has a hard time for whatever reason getting below 130 pounds, while another woman feels or has a hard time getting below 115 pounds. And the difference between them is, quote unquote, their set point level or their ease of being able to have any sort of weight loss, or them having metabolic resistance to that dieting episode or to getting down in weight. And this is trying to assume, like, let's just try and assume that they have like the same muscle mass, that really this is, we're talking about just fat mass that is taking place or physical weight that is taking place. It becomes kind of more problematic when you're talking about actual weight. So I guess we could be actually talking about body fat content, and that would be a little bit easier, but people usually think in terms of weight. So I mean, to say body fat levels as well, like one has a hard time getting below 21% body fat and another has a hard time getting below 18. That's probably a simpler way of saying it. So that's what the set point theory is. And this theory is based upon that when they get to that level, or when you get to that level, that you have a hard time dropping weight, quote unquote, no matter how low your calories go, or you have a hard time getting lower because your hunger levels are too aggressive. You have very poor training recovery. The problems start to kick in. Body temperature gets low, et cetera, et cetera. Are these things true, or can, anecdotally speaking, we say that there is a set point for each person on a certain level? There is truth to it. I think the problem is that when you're testing it in a study sense, and when you're testing it on yourself, is that there are so many variables that come into play. Can you easily say in a free living society that that a certain amount of people have a hard time getting below a certain weight versus other people getting lower in weight? Absolutely. Like that's 100% a truthful statement. Some people can drop body fat easier than others. Why? It's such a varied amount of reasons that can take place, from lifestyle, emotional problems, environmental issues, how you were raised, psychological things with what you actually see as being comfortable and accepting with yourself. I mean, you can literally look at one person and go, okay, well, maybe to them, 130 is acceptable enough, to whereas this person, 115 is acceptable enough. And it can be that simple because of how someone's mind view is of what they will accept or what they will keep trying for, or keep pushing for. And while they may somewhere in their mind want to get lower, there could be psychological reasons they're battling themselves, and they are mostly content with that weight, whereas somebody else is mostly content at a lower weight. It can be that simple. There could be that simple of a psychological issue, let alone there being issues with leptin receptors and all kinds of physical properties that are taking part in the body, hormones and things like that. So each person we are our little snowflakes. That is exactly what we are. And so saying that that we don't have a different response to dropping fat, body fat, and losing weight and things like that, or how we retain water. If someone has a thyroid problem versus someone does not, if someone has a tendency towards leg-based edema, or peripheral edema issues, and one person has to wear compression socks and one does not. I mean, all these things are going to change things. Your ethnicity background, everything is going to affect how easily you can or cannot lose weight, period. let alone what point you're going to run into really big problems with stalls and fat loss and things like that. So set point is definitely true in that kind of a sense. Where I have some semantic arguments based upon with it is when people make statements in which that if we are aware of these things, and if we are taking place in proper refeeding and retraining and if we are aware and understanding of the kind of alterations that can happen for us when we get in lower body fat levels, and we make those adjustments, can we still not get lower? And some people say that no matter what we do, it won't happen. The body will fight it. That's where I have a problem with the statement. And that's where I usually see the statement going. And that's where my issue is with the set point theory is that what I think is in a free living, minorly conscious of what is taking place, most people will hit stalls or have problems at certain levels for whatever reasons. And just dieting in general. Let's just talk about dieting in general. And that is where it's like, yeah, dieting as a whole does not work in a mindset sense, but deficits have to take place to lose weight or to lose body fat. So that can actually be an issue, but if you're aware of it, can you not manipulate it? Can you not work within what you know of yourself, your environment, your problems, your systems? Can you not manipulate things to physically get your body down to a lower body fat point, even if it's naturally or intuitively not so easy to do? That's where I have an argument, because I have seen where in medical research and in studies, we see in all kinds of cases that everyone can achieve very low body fat if they so desire. Keeping it can be a different story for, again, very different reasons. But to say that it's physically impossible, it's a double-edged sword a little bit. It's an interesting topic, because on some hand, you could say, yes, well, free living and being just completely unaware, if I can't keep it and if I have to work so hard, that isn't something that I can keep and it isn't natural for me to keep. That's a good argument. Maybe there's a mindset issue that you could help with yourself to get into a different kind of mindset to where it's not an unhealthy thing, or maybe getting into that mindset would be unhealthy for you. And as you can see, it's not a black and white thing in any way, shape, or form. And I think when looking at set point or looking at where you can live with your body, with yourself, you have to take in a lot into account. You have to take in how much you're willing to train in a day, what your lifestyle is, what kind of sacrifices you want to make with nutrition to your mindset and how it is that you have to be. To some degree, that is going to take into account what your set point is. And then do you have any medical issues? Are you just, you know, a puffier person than some other people are and you retain for whatever reason, because of your background, your genes, or because of the things that you just gravitate towards eating, whatever. All these things need to kind of take into account when you're looking at your full body goal and these kinds of things. So I think set point is a fantastic topic and discussion. I think that it's commonly misused. And I don't like the topic title for this talk, Why Dieting Doesn't Work, because it implies in some ways that going on a calorically restricted diet doesn't work to lose weight or lose body fat, which is the only thing that works to lose body fat. But I do like it in the sense of it being more philosophical, where it's talking about mindset and how we look at or approach losing body fat. So it's that kind of like, it's just the play on words things and how we look at it. But that's my take on it. And that's kind of my opinion of what I think maybe Jonas was getting at. If you weren't and you really wanted me to go off on intuitive eating, well, too bad, because I screwed you there.
It is an interesting topic.
It is. All of it is very interesting. Yeah. And the whole question, there's many places I could go into this, the whole entire question for mindful eating and things like that as well. But I'm wondering, or I'm feeling, because when this topic comes up, because I've been asked about this video a few times, it's set points that's usually mm-hmm. what people want to be discussed the most. So hopefully I discuss what you wanted me to discuss, Jonas. Hope so.
And if not, too bad. Last episode of the Fitcast ever today. Shutting down shop. I'm disconnecting the microphone. All right, no, I'm just kidding. So Sarah B, I'm going to get your question, Sarah. You thought I was going to leave you out. What's up, Lee? Throwback. It's a throwback callback.
Throwback.
How's your fat loss going that you mentioned a few months
ago? And all personal and stuff, Sarah B.
Months back. Yeah, it's just what's up?
Yeah, she just wants to know what my fat loss is doing.
It's always...
I'm good. You don't have to finish the question. It's okay. Basically, am I fat still? You know, not that I was fat anyway, but no, it's going along good. I'm tweaking now. I'm at a tweaking stage. I'm just chiseling away to maybe a little bit of fat, adding a little bit of muscle, focusing on training. I had a tiny little, I hate talking about injuries because I swear to God, people think I'm so, I keep hurting myself that has nothing to do with training. It has nothing to do with training, but I had a tiny little injury. And
were you at the strip club?
Exactly. Yeah, you know, I was up on the pole and yep. I just slid down wrong way and you know, I got burned in a weird place.
Best
and
of us.
It just, it's whatever. I had to take just an itty bitty time off of some things. But I'm back in the game and doing my thing. And basically I'm chiseling away. I got the majority of the loss that I needed to get off. And maybe I'm like, I don't know, I'm kind of in that five ish. Yeah, like maybe I'd like to lose 5 to 7 more pounds of fat. And maybe in that zone, maybe, I don't know. It's kind of hard to say because I can be kind of puffy. I can be kind of puffy and I have water issues. I still have some water issues happening from my hormones regulating out from my surgeries and stuff. And my hormones are still, my levels are still coming back a little odd and not bad. Just they're adjusting. And my, not to get too personal, but my cycle is still like, it's acting kind of like a little funny. So I think there's some things with that are to take into account. So ladies, you know, these things matter. They do. But other than that, things are going very well, and it's just kind of add a little takeaway. I'm in more of a recomp zone now, I think, than just like a straight fat loss zone. And I'm just taking some time to build a little bit muscle. And if I get into another cut, I'm probably going to do it somewhere around March. That's like really aggressive. If I need to like kind of chisel off, because you know I'm going to the summit, fitness summit plug May. Just letting you know. And I got to make sure I'm looking good, yeah, because the Fass is going to be there, from my understanding, the John Fass, and I got to make sure I'm looking good for him. You know, even though he's a taken man now, you know, I make sure that I still look good for him.
It's like an international thing, though. You know,
I know.
You always have a little something on the side.
Different hose and area codes, you know.
Yep. Rush hour too. Yep. Cool. Let's go to. Next question. You talked a little bit about this before, kind of the same subject, and I've seen you. People tend to sometimes post misinformation on Facebook and on other, you know, websites, and it's good to kind of make sure that people aren't putting out misinformation. But Kim had a question, and really, she said she wanted to know how going gluten free has altered your perspective or approach to nutrition, health, and training. And I know we talked about this a little bit on the show before, but obviously this is one of those hot new topics that people are using in terms of selling programs and foods and things like that.
Yeah. I'm just yeah, when I was having my own dietary problems, and I want to make this very clear, because some people have asked me randomly, because they, you know, they get bits and pieces, and we can't caveat at like every single, you know, preface every single topic that we discuss. But when I made the dietary restrictions that I made, it was because, and let me make this very clear, I was throwing up like every day. I couldn't keep food down. I swelled by like 20 pounds, even in a caloric deficit of like just water retention. I could barely lift my body to do a push-up, let alone like other kinds of strength training activities that I was previously totally fine and perfectly capable of doing. My body shut the hell down. Like it just did. So when I restricted foods to see, based upon a consultation with a doctor, when I restricted foods to see what could or could not be a problem, I restricted, amongst other things, wheat, because I was told by allergy specialists that I might have a problem with wheat, amongst some other things. It's very hard to test food allergies, so I restricted it to see if, among other things, that would help me with things. So I did not go like gluten free in the sense of like a fad diet sense. I was told by a doctor that my you know, that things interacting in my body were not going right. And I was doing research and figured that, you know, hey, maybe why not? Let's cut this out and see how it works. So understand that that's why I chose to have a food restricted diet, not because I felt that when I ate carbs, I went up 2 pounds. And I mean that so respectfully to someone who gets scared in that kind of incident, because I understand the fear of it. And I talk about the fear of that, and I am not belittling the fear of that. But when I made dietary restrictions and decisions, it was because I was physically ill, very, very sick. Now, it turns out that a lot of my problems were because I had a softball in my stomach in the shape of a tumor, and I didn't realize that that was causing a lot of problems. So, you know, that'll do stuff to you. And it, we figured out a lot of stuff when that came out, and I've been feeling great. I've been feeling amazing since that came out of me. So, you know, that was obviously a big part of the problem. I still have lots of food sensitivities because I'm the boy in a plastic bubble, but I've been reintroducing foods, and I've been having very little problems with reintroducing foods, and everything seems to be fine. I guess my point is that if you're going to have a dietary restriction, it needs to be for a reason, not because of a fad. And as we just talked about with the study earlier about the pure wheat gluten protein intake, we saw a decrease in inflammation, not an increase. And there is lots of research that suggests that wheat intake or that grains that carry gluten proteins in them can actually be healing to the stomach lining, heals the stomach lining, not destroys. And there is no reason, unless you have a disease or an allergy or an illness, a specific disease or anything like that, to avoid any type of food or any sort of product. And I guess if anything, what going gluten-free has done for me, or to alter my perspective, or making any sort of dietary restrictions has done to alter my perspective, is to show that a lot of those dietary restrictions didn't help me because I had a very severe medical problem going on. And the ones that did were immediate reactions. Like, for example, I can't eat dairy. It's so sad. But I literally have pustules will pop up on my face. Like, it is an instantaneous reaction that takes place. And I'm not saying that there can't be subtle reactions, and things like celiac disease have a completely different method of working, and you can get that evaluated by a doctor. But my point is that for a lot of these things that take place, and for a lot of things people are talking about, there's instantaneous reactions, and there are very real symptoms and side effects to problems that are taking place. And that most of the time, what we think are problems or we think are issues, they are not, or they are a separate thing that we need to look at and analyze. And I really think that food restriction or a special dietary restriction of one product or one type of thing is still not the way to go. And that instead moderation and learning how to live with multiple food items or multiple types of food products in your life is probably going to be the best way to go for you from a mental healthy mindset. And as always, check with your doctor, because they're who we should go to if there is a problem with our body, that especially regarding nutrition and things like that. So, yeah, that's what I've learned.
Interesting. Another interesting subject.
Yes. Yes. Very interesting subject.
Yeah. So let's go into a question from, this is a cool name. That's why I'm going to go to this question.
That's the only reason you're even asking the question, is because you want to say the name.
Zoran. Because it's like Zoltar from Big, starring Tom Hanks.
Yeah.
And the guy from Home Alone. How can we begin to notice in our new clients that they might not respond well to a caloric deficit, from estrogen to progesterone imbalance to chronic stress or prolonged dieting? What questions do we need to ask? What are the red flags? When should we start thinking about referring out?
Real quick, what guy in Home Alone?
He was the father in Home Alone, was also John, in Big. He played
John
the
kind Hurt of the, was in John Hurt was in
correct. Big? He played the bad guy.
He did play the
so, bad guy. No, he was like in that scene where he's like, I don't get it.
He was the boyfriend
of the woman
of Elizabeth Perkins.
Yeah, yeah, of the 12-year-old boy that ended up having sex with her.
This is what's important. It's not the question at all. Okay. Yeah. Okay. So, yeah, What are the right? How about this? You're never going to understand what a hormonal imbalance is going to look like in your client just from looking at them, no matter what people tell you. So don't even like try and go there. Like, you're just going to have to send somebody to a doctor. Because I mean, you can look at someone, and to a degree, you can see certain things, like you, edema, for example. You can certainly see physical signs of swelling and things like that. And there are some speculations at times that certain physical features can attribute to certain symptoms. But a lot of that is really sketchy. And it also is, nothing is better than a blood test. So if someone is having problems with their hormonal profile, these things kind of do come into effect. So I will put it like this. When you know that someone is not responding well to a caloric deficit, is essentially when they don't feel good, meaning that they're extremely fatigued, they have aggressive insomnia, anxiety, depression, they are apathetic, their NEAT or their NEPA, their daily movement or activity has decreased because the body is probably more than likely trying to slow it down so that their caloric intake can start to match with their caloric expenditure. They do not recover well from workouts or training sessions. They are run down. Their repetitions are getting lower to where they previously used to be, or their max numbers are decreasing. All of these kinds of things are a very good sign. And most of all, they are not seeing any loss in body fat. I don't say just weight, because that can be tricky. But in short, there's no changes in body fat composition, and there also could be increases in water composition level or in water retention, edema, things of that nature. So if all of those things are taking place, you can kind of say, okay, there is a more aggressive inflammatory or stress response that is taking place here. There are negative side effects to this deficit. And while that does not mean the individual is not going to still lose body fat on some sort of small level, it probably means that they are entered into a more aggressive metabolic adaptive state, to where they're trying to do everything they can. Their body is trying to do everything it can to lower its metabolic rate or output to as closely as possible match the caloric intake that is happening. So if the output is, previously trying to be conceived at 500 calories, it's doing everything it can to lower that deficit to 200 or 100 calories, which should take you forever to see a reaction from that on any sort of real level. And usually binging or loss of dietary control is going to come into play. So if your client is also having those kind of responses, and then they start to report binging episodes where they have lost control and they have just eaten a ton of food in a short period of time, then it would suggest that the restriction is too aggressive, and they're having problems keeping up with the demands of their training and deficit program. That is another sign. And you put all that together, and it's going to be poor results. The client isn't going to get the results they want, or you, the listener, if you're going through this yourself, you're not going to get the results you want. And the best thing that you can do for that client or individual is to take a maintenance break, not just a refeed or a cheat day or cheat meals or off days or things like that, where you have a day here or there or a meal here or there where you have an increase in caloric intake, but an extended period of time of maintenance caloric eating. If there is a presence of any sort of fear of that, you can raise to those calories rather than just do it instantaneously. But the goal is to eat at maintenance for need at that period of time, and for the allotted time that you need. Anyone listening to this can type in starvation mode Lee Pill into Google. It'll take you to an article on my blog that gives a chart that shows the days and span of times in which you can match that up with. And that can just be a little guide that you go by, and you can read the article in general, and it talks about adaptation and quote unquote starvation mode and what that means in more. But as far as referring out goes, it's hard to say. If you see any sort of symptoms of someone that is doing any sort of purposeful damage to their body, they're purposely not eating a very high amount of calories, you think that there could be an anorexia issue or a bulimic issue present. If you feel that there could be any sort of exercise addiction taking place or some sort of really aggressive body dysmorphia issue, you have to understand as well that when people get into a caloric deficit state, it actually alters their hormones. It alters their serotonin, dopamine levels, all these types of things. And they are more susceptible to having issues with obsessiveness or with compulsive behaviors, with having these kind of responses in general. So that's where the whole like dieting can be a trigger thing in a sense. So they're not always necessarily thinking logically. And I don't mean to say that, oh, a good meal is going to fix their mindset, but things can be worse or exaggerated from where their just normal eating mindset state could be at from just a psychological standpoint there. So it's hard to say if you see those kinds of things happening, if you see someone being overly aggressive and restrictive and they seem to be in an unhealthy mindset, then you can say to them, look, I really think that you need to talk to someone. I think that this is something that you should try discuss with a psychiatrist or a psychologist. And from a physical standpoint, if you notice that maybe their mindset is really good, but they're physically having some problems, they refeed and things still aren't good, or they're still having like issues with fatigue or things like that, and you know it's not caloric, and you know that you've done good with their training, that you've taken deloads, you've taken breaks, you're going by the book as good as you can to take care of them as good as you can, and there's still problems, then maybe there's an issue with their thyroid, maybe there's testosterone issues, maybe there's different things that are taking place and going on, and recommending someone going to just a GP or even someone as more complex as an endocrinologist can be like a really good idea. So obviously we're not doctors and whatnot, but for casual conversation, if you're just like, hey, you know, I've read about this stuff and we seem to be doing everything good, if you're still not feeling well, maybe you should go to the doctor and get this checked out and talk to them about, you know, what it is that we're doing, what it is that's going on with us, tell them what kind of tests that maybe you'd want to look at doing, and just be really open and communicate with them well. And you can do that, and it can help your client. We do not have to pretend in any way, shape, or form that we are physicians or that we are treating anyone for anything, but we can be good friends. We can be good professionals, and we can say, hey, I'm aware of some of these things, and I want to make sure that I'm looking out for your health and well-being, I see something here that isn't normal, and it's my job and it's ethical to me to simply say to you, I think that you should go get that looked at by someone who would know better than I. And I think that's when we should step in and do that. So, yeah.
There Very cool. Yeah. I think we're getting close to time.
Yeah.
Let me think. I'm going to just go through these questions real quick. Yeah, no, it looks like I think we got everything on the outline. So that's where we're going to wrap it up. You guys got back-to-back episodes of Lee Peel from LeePeel.com. And you can listen to the off-topic if you want. It's interesting. you can hear how I spent another $1,000 on video games, an extra on top of what I spent a couple weeks before. This is what happens when you unfortunately have credit cards. So thanks everyone for listening. Lee, obviously people can check out LeePeel.com, and also that's pretty much the one-stop shop for all your
stuff. Facebook Lee Peel, Twitter Lee Peel. I'm a complete narcissist.
You gotta work on the Twitter stuff.
Oh God, I know. It's so sad.
It works on your phone, you know. Take pictures of Katie in her outfit.
I'm so bad at that stuff. I'm always going to be bad at it, Kevin. Yeah. Let's just not depress me. Let's leave on a high note, you know?
All right, well, that's going to wrap it up for this episode of the FitCast. Thank you so much for listening. You can go to iTunes, subscribe on there. Please submit a review if you haven't already. I would really appreciate it. Like I said, if you want to support the show, there's a great little donation tab on the right-hand side. You can just go through PayPal. It takes a couple seconds. And I really appreciate all the support that you guys have given us. It's kind of reinvigorated me to make sure we continue to get these out on a regular basis. Also, if you have any guests that you want to want me to try to get on the show, you can just email me at kevin@thefitcast.com. Or if you just have anything else you want to talk about, if you want to check out a fantastic top of the line, usually in the top 15 or 20 retro video game podcasts on iTunes, Back in My Play is a fantastic resource and a lot of fun. Has some of the biggest names in the industry on the show. And also you get to hear me talk about something I am very passionate and excited about, along with fitness and nutrition. So it's good stuff. I think that's it. Right?
Yeah. No, I think you got it. I think now it's just like the play us out, you know.
I wish I could use that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so just download Halcyon on yeah, and on so, iTunes or so open stop, it up on YouTube.
So at this point of the episode, start playing the song.
Or listen to Johnny Lee Miller and Angelina yep. Jolie do it.
There you go.
To that song. All right. Thanks for listening. Stay around for the off topic if you want to listen to that. Thanks, Lee.
Bye.
All right, you're not crazy. I guess you already know that this isn't the same episode as last week, but I'm Kevin, and I'm back with Lee. How you doing?
I'm fine. It's like some sort of like delusions that they don't realize it's a Groundhog Day. Groundhog Day!
Yeah, no, I was thinking about... I wasn't going to play that, but I was just going to play Halcyon on and on. Arr. Just like for just the whole like 8-minute track for the outro for the episode today. Because somehow I got onto, someone on the internet said The Hackers is a terrible movie. And I'm like, you're nuts.
They're crazy.
You're nuts. It,
no taste whatsoever.
The technology doesn't hold up today. And how they're hacking, you know, Penn Jillette's computer does not hold up today. Or what was the other guy's name? The other guy from Short Circuit was in it. But,
no one ever knows his name.
I totally do.
I don't know what his name is.
But anyways.
I mean, I know it's Eugene in the movie. I don't know what it is, and that's how well I know it, but I don't know what his real name is.
But the soundtrack for that movie is so good that there's two volumes of it.
It's a fantastic soundtrack. You got the Stereo MCs. There's so much good there. You got Orbital. Well,
that's the thing, is it holds up today. More than the movie, obviously, but that soundtrack, like, you can listen to it today and be like, wow, this could have just come out this past, at least for a good majority of the songs on the soundtrack. But highly recommend you pick it up, but you cannot get it digitally through Amazon, which is a terrible thing.
You can't?
No, you can only get the actual CD, which is actually rare and expensive now. So if you have a copy,
I have that.
Good. I used to have volume two,
like
which
a
is
baseball
like,
card.
I know I used to have, I picked up volume two when I saw the movie. And when I originally got a portable CD player, I bought my brother's old Sony Discman off him. That was my first CD player. And I went to I don't know if you had these, they're called Strawberries. It's like a record store when they still had them. And, I was looking for The Hacker soundtrack specifically, but all they had was volume two, which has a bunch of different songs. And like today, that thing is $100, but I do not know where that CD is. I probably sold it or traded it in or something.
What a shame that you lost that treasure.
But that's why you have great things like, other web services.
Other web services.
That you can pick them up.
iTunes,
yeah,
where you legally purchase.
Oh, they must have it on iTunes.
They have to. I know. They have to. Well, even if they don't, you can just get the track listing and get everything.
Oh no, they don't. Wow, that's a bummer. it's these licensed soundtracks. I mean, Steve Jobs is probably rolling around in his grave right now because of this. Accurate soundtrack.
What are you doing this weekend?
I just dropped $500. Well, I spent about $1,000 in the last 48 hours on Neo Geo hardware that allows me to play these Neo Geo cassettes or game tapes that I had for my arcade machine. But I got rid of the arcade machine because, you know, I'm growing up. You know, I shouldn't have arcade machines in my living room and all that stuff. So instead, I bought a thing that was $500. And allows me to play those through my TV with a fantastic picture quality. And because I did that, I had to spend about $160 to get two controllers for it. And then I spent about another $350 on a couple new games just because, you know, if you're going to be going in for $500, you might as well go in for $1,000. And I got a buddy coming over tomorrow after work, and we're going to be playing some games. And I'm actually going to be interviewing the guy that created this piece of hardware, and he uses old arcade hardware, like abandoned motherboards from old machines, because a lot of times these machines get demolished because they just take up room, but the parts are saved to be resold. And he takes the old motherboards and puts them into a super nice casing to make it look like the Neo Geo home console that people sold, or that they sold like in 93. But I'll just take 1 second on this. So when Neo Geo came out, there was the hardware in the arcade and the hardware.
Oh my God,
at home.
You're having like a nerd orgasm right now. But it's fantastic.
But the,
keep going.
Okay, the games themselves were pretty close to the same. They actually were the same games. That's why the Neo Geo home console, it was sold next to like the Super Nintendo and the Sega Genesis, it was $600 in 1993. So only the richest of the rich kids had this, or the crazy of the crazies had it. And the games were $300 a piece. They were $299 compared to like the $50, $60 Super Nintendo game that was sold at the same time. So with this modified arcade hardware, you can actually play the arcade cassettes or the arcade carts instead of the home carts, which are different. They have a different pinout. And doing this, you can get most games for far cheaper. Like there's some games, like Metal Slug is a very common game that people know about. It's about $45 to $50 to get the arcade cart versus about $1,000 for the AES or the home version. So this guy is actually really cool. He's out in California and he makes these things. And I was like, dude, you know, I just bought one of these, but you know, I think it would be good for the podcast to, you know, have you on and to talk about this stuff. So I'm going to be interviewing him tomorrow night after I have my buddy come over to play some Samurai Showdown and some, you know, other cool games for the Neo Geo. I don't know. Some other stuff might come in the mail tomorrow. So we'll see.
That was a massive amount to take in.
You have to be excited.
I listened to most of it. I was sexting during... I just had to stop. And
you have to be excited about something that you're going to spend that much money on.
No, I know. Like, I'm so happy for you.
Otherwise,
what
are you doing?
I am.
Because then I'd be wasting my money.
You embrace it with all its glory that it deserves.
And there will be a video up on youtube.com/backinmyplay if you want to check out what it is.
Are you doing video casts?
Yeah, I have a ton of episodes. I have a series called The Weekend Rental where I pick up a game. I'd say 90% of the videos, I usually do about two a week, just so like 30-minute videos. It's not a lot of editing. And I usually pick up a game that I've never played before. I do a pre-video with the webcam just to show you the cart and or the box or whatever. So you can really see what it's like to actually own this thing. And then I boot it up and I capture the video from it through my upscaling hardware and do live commentary during it. And it's actually gotten a pretty good pickup from people, thanks to guys like the Player One podcast talking about it and helping spread the word.
You're going to move on to a whole different field without us, Kevin.
There's no money in it. That's the problem. And I can't ever accept any sponsorship for it because I used music from video games. And if I made money off it, they could.
Oh, I got you. I got you.
So yeah. I can't do any of that. I want to do t-shirts, though. We have a cool logo.
You should do t-shirts.
I'm trying. They're
maybe like cup cozies.
They're expensive. It's so hard to get good.
Seriously, you know that.
Yeah, well, we did t-shirts for the Fitcast a long time ago, and they were on.
Well, I know you did t-shirts, but you know what cup cozies cost?
Well, sure. The problem is the printing, and the problem is printing something like a logo with more than three colors is super expensive.
No, I hear you.
Because it's you got to use multiple colors of ink and all this stuff. So, yeah, that's going to be my weekend playing with these gigantic, like double the size of a VHS Neo Geo carts.
You go buck wild.
I will. And it'll give me something to buy when I'm in Japan again. Another good thing to go to the arcade shops for.
Good. I'm very glad.
How about you?
Fun.
What are you doing?
Tomorrow night, I'm going to a strip club.
Oh, great. Which one?
I don't remember the name of it. A friend of mine is
females or males?
It's females. Mm. A friend of mine is having a birthday, and
a guy or a girl?
Yeah, a guy. Okay. And him and his wife and me and Katie, the VP of my corporation, we're all gonna go to a strip club to celebrate for his birthday. It's been a really long time since I've been the one. And so I'm gonna make it rain.
Go to the bank?
I'm not even kidding that I have like wrapped like stacks of ones.
Yeah, no.
And it's gonna be very fun. And
that's weird.
He has a particular affection for redheads, so Katie's gonna dress up as Jessica Rabbit.
Hey Katie, if you want to send me some pictures of that, my phone number is 781.
Yeah, no, she was Jessica Rabbit for Halloween.
I do remember
like
seeing that
last year or something like that. And she, because of her hair, you know, like it's perfect. It just looks fantastic. So he doesn't know it. She's going to dress up as Jessica Rabbit and we're going to all just go out. I mean, I don't know if you can say it's all in good, clean fun at a strip club, but it really is. Like it's just all in fun.
It really depends on the two times that I've been to strip clubs. There was a severe, there was a wide gap in quality between the two places, one being at New York City at Rick's Cabaret, which is actually on the NASDAQ. That's their big thing, is that we're a publicly traded company. And this just random place in Orlando, Florida, which I'm sorry, if you live in Florida, I'm sure you're trying, but Florida's the worst. And their strip clubs are not much much better. But
you're going to have some Florida person that's going to write into you right after they hear this and be like, very angry, because I am sure there is some sort of crazy upscale strip club in Florida.
Well, I just went to these ones just due to a friend's a wedding, like a bachelor party, and a night before the wedding, like, yeah, last second, let's go. Woo-hoo! Let's get into a taxi, you know, find us a strip club. And at both locations, there were no ones used. It was just like $20 per lap dance. And that was just, you were just lap dancing it up. But maybe that's because we're high rollers.
Wow.
Just straight up 20s.
Big ballin', you're like straight up like bottle service kind of guys. Like
that's what
dances.
We did both times. Yeah. And it's like $400 for the bottle of the worst vodka you've ever had, like a bottle of vodka and, you know, some Red Bull to mix it with. Gross. That was terrible.
Yeah. Well, that's what my weekend holds.
But you did it right, because you went to the bank first, and you're not going to have to deal with, I think at both places it was $20 fee to use the ATM.
Yeah, no, I'm not going to fall for that.
No.
I'm not going to be, no. Mm-mm. No, I already got my one situation taken care of, and there's going to be a little pre-gaming, because that'd be expensive. So,
you're having an economic strip
club
visit.
I'm having an economic good time with the strippers. Yes. It's going to be good. It's going to be fun, though. I'm looking forward to it.
You're like the kids whose parents would, like, you know, stop by at the grocery store and you'd buy candy there and then you stuff it in your pants before going
little
to
bit,
the movie theater.
A little bit, you know, except you can only sneak in so much to a strip club, especially for what it is you're enjoying.
Mm. Yeah.
But I'm not going to go there with where my mind just went. But yeah, it should be good fun.
Yeah, you know, just pack some hand sanitizer. It'll be good. Because they don't have, you think they would have hand sanitizer things at the thing.
They don't. But where we're going, it's a very nice, I don't remember the name of it, but it's a very classy joint. It's very classy. It's very upscale. Very nice joint.
As long as there's not like a guy's name in the title, like Bills.
Oh, no. No. Like Phil Presents.
Yeah.
Yeah. No.
Phil's Girls of the East Coast.
That was good. That I'm sure that exists. I'm sure it exists here.
Yeah.
I know it exists in Jersey.
Yeah. I've heard. Yeah. I don't know.
You know it exists in Jersey. So, yeah. Anyway, that is what I'm doing Saturday and some various other things on the weekend that are much more. I guess family
next
oriented.
Day, going to church.
You know? Yeah, exactly. On Sunday, I'm gonna pray.
Gonna volunteer at the food pantry.
Exactly. I'm gonna feed some homeless people and you know help figure out world peace and all that kind of stuff.
But
Saturday,
shelter.
I'm making it rain. That's what's happening. Yeah.
So. Well, good. You know, I think you know those. You know, folks that work there are, you know, that's their job and you're just helping support the local economy. If you really want to break it down, that's all you're doing because that money is going right back into the local economy. And, you know, you never know when they're going to need nutrition help because that's a business where you really, you know, are encouraged to
stay
in shape.
It is about body composition.
Yeah.
And it is really, it's research.
Unless you like big butts.
I'm going for research.
Yeah. Oh, you could write this off.
I am. I could totally write it off. The tax write-off, it's about research for body composition in the world of exotic dancing.
You know how much money you could probably make off an ebook about like, you know, the best program for strippers
and how fun would it be to shoot those videos?
Yeah. You know, just let me know what the membership site link is. I will.
I'll be the behind the scenes operator for that.
Yeah. Yeah, no, we'll see. anything else you got going on? Did you watch Mr. Selfridge?
No, I haven't watched it yet, but I talked about it endlessly, and it's all ready to go. It's in line. I can't wait, and I probably by the next time we talk, I will definitely watch it.
Okay, let's talk about non-strip clubs.